Welcome to the Parables of the Master podcast. In this episode, we will explore the second parable of the Christ titled New Wine and Old Wineskin. It is the very next verse in the Gospel of Matthew and immediately follows the old patch on the new garment parable. Prior to diving in, it is imperative to once again familiarize oneself with the context under which it was used. For simplicity, I have once again included that here. While Jesus was sitting with tax collectors and sinners, questions started to circulate about why he taught sinners. To this, the master replied that it was only the sick who needed a doctor and not the healthy. Later, they started to question the devotion of his disciples to God by asking why they didn't fast as often as the disciples of John and the Pharisees did. To which he replied, "How can the guests of the bridegroom mourn while he is still with them? When he's taken away, then they will fast." For the sake of deepening our understanding, it is important to note that in spiritual practice, fasting is considered a self-sacrifice, a way of temporarily giving up one's source of life energy and intentionally entering a state of suffering in order to get closer to God. His point is that, if everything is perfectly fine here and now, why would they consciously engage in activities such as fasting that's going to do nothing but introduce a problem for them unnecessarily? Jesus makes it clear that he is the cause of their state of being by referring to his self as the bridegroom. In their day, without the groom, there could be no wedding, and thus, there would be no reason for the gathering, no cause for celebration, and no source of happiness for the guests. Once the groom is gone, however, and the wedding comes to an end, everyone goes back to their normal lives and their previous states of being. And it is only then that they may do as others do, struggle or strive, and even fast. In addition to this context, listening and meditating on the new patch episode is a requisite before we investigate new wine, so that we may engage in a fair amount of comparing and contrasting between the two parables in order to determine how they are alike and different. If you haven't already, please listen to that lesson first. On the surface, these parables appear to be similar and in fact are often studied as one unit. However, given that there are some clear differences between the two, we are studying them separately. These differences mainly pertain to the spiritual journey of a seeker and some of the initial challenges we tend to discover on the path. It is through this lens that we shall study this parable in greater detail. Prior to going any further, it is also important to keep an open mind. If you've studied this parable in the past, whether on your own or in a group, and arrived at a different understanding, those differences will also be of critical importance to fully grasp what's being taught. Without further ado, let's dive right in and explore the second parable of the Master, New Wine in Old Wineskins. The Gospel according to St. Matthew, verse 9:17. Neither do men pour new wine into old wineskins. If they do, the skins will burst, the wine will run out, and the wineskins would be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins, and both are preserved. This parable may introduce some fairly new concepts for some, so it's important to first and foremost provide some background clarification. There were a lot of uses for sheep or goatskin in the time of Christ. Most notably and relevant to this lesson is the wineskin, a container or vessel for storing wine. Remember that Jesus spoke to an entirely different age and culture than ours. Therefore, it is of critical importance to have a solid grasp of the processes of the time in order to have a better chance at understanding his teaching. Upon doing a bit of research, I found that wine was traditionally made by first harvesting the grapes and pressing them to release their juice. The pressing process is best achieved when the grapes are pressed by human feet. If the grapes are pressed too hard, the seeds would burst and release a dry and bitter taste into the grape juice. This bitterness ultimately contributed to yielding a lower quality wine. It is believed that the pressing of the grapes was done in a ritualistic and celebratory manner, accompanied by song and dance. The celebration itself was believed to be a factor that helped improve the quality of the wine by injecting good energy into it. This way, that energy would be enjoyed and released upon consumption in future festivities. For what it's worth, This celebratory process is still used in some vineyards today in Mexico and California. The pressed juice would then flow towards a larger vessel called a vat, commonly made from limestone, wood, or clay. In this vessel, the wine underwent the initial fermentation process. This process commonly took around 5 days, as the grape skin and other impurities rose to the top, where they can be collected and discarded. Finally, some optional flavoring and spicing of the wine would also be done at this point. The wine would then be stirred and filtered to pull away additional impurities before it was transferred into airtight jars or wineskins for aging and additional fermentation. In the case of the wineskins, they commonly also had a strap where they could be hung in storage rooms or on transport carriages. When the wineskins were opened so that the wine could be served, they took in air and hardened. This hardening process caused the skins to lose their elasticity and ability to stretch further. This made old wineskins a poor choice of vessel for new wines since they could no longer adapt to the conditions created by the fermentation process. If the old wineskins were reused with new wine, the force of the gases released during fermentation would cause them to burst and the wine to spill. Though not relevant to the purpose of understanding this parable, it should also be noted that it was in fact possible to reuse wineskins by treating them in a special way with oil. The process served to soften the skin to regain some of its original flexibility. However, these older vessels were better suited as containers for already aged wine or wine that was expected to ferment only for a short time prior to consumption. This parable is almost perfectly symmetric with the old patch parable, particularly around the nature of the problem. Recall that in order to address the problem of the tear upon our garment, it was necessary to first see the actual problem clearly before seeking a solution or a patch to fix it. Then, the solution needed to be carefully inspected and evaluated before being put into practice, just as the patch needed to be sufficiently shrunk before it could be sewn on the new garment. However, in this parable, there is no actual problem until one is created. Though at first glance the parable seems similar, unless we carefully inspect, we could easily miss this point. By stating both parables back to back in simple language, the master is saying, when you become aware of a problem, don't waste your time getting emotional submerged in fear, anger, self-pity, guilt, or regret. Otherwise, this state becomes the actual problem you need to deal with first. Rather, calm down, be patient, stay aware and objective, in order to see both the problem and the solution clearly. Think hard before you apply a solution to solve the problem, so that you don't make matters worse. Secondly, even when there are no problems and things seem good, continue to be fully aware so that you don't knowingly do something to create a problem. It's perfectly okay to make mistakes and learn from them. It's not okay to take actions you know will lead to problems for you or for others. Though we familiarized ourselves with the elaborate process of making wine, notice how the parable leaves that out entirely. Instead, it starts at the wine and its creation is completely irrelevant. It is my understanding that both the patch and the wine represent information of a different nature. The patch represents information that is sought out by us in order to fix a problem. It is information we have an immediate need for, while the wine represents information that arrives at us without desire or control. Perhaps it is information we picked up somewhere along the way, like online, or in a book, or from a film or documentary, from a story, or even a lesson learned in school. Perhaps it's something overheard in a conversation that could just not be helped, or someone randomly engaged us and had something to say. In either case, whether we know it or not, take it on consciously or not, whether we have a need for it or not, that information becomes a part of us and, however insignificantly, changes us in some way. Think of the winemaking process detailed earlier in the episode. Though it was mostly irrelevant information for the specific task of understanding the parable, if you were at all attentive, you had no choice but to receive it. And in receiving it, it will be a part of you for at least a little while. Try as you might, you can't selectively forget what you've been exposed to. Such is the nature of belief. We've been exposed to the same information for so long that it has taken root within us and hardened, resembling a subjective truth. Suppose I wasn't completely honest about that winemaking process. or modified a few details here and there. Or suppose the sources I got the information from were completely false, and in my ignorance, I passed that fallacy on to you. In either case, my motives are irrelevant to the end result that you're unknowingly holding false information, mistaking it for truth. Being honest, you may decide to share that information on or use it to defend your position in a debate because you now think you know something about the subject matter. The stronger your conviction about that which you hold to be true, the more it hardens within you and calcifies. Thus, the more fiercely you are likely to defend it. The great spiritual teacher, J. Krishnamurti, said that belief is not merely a part of you or something that belongs to you, but instead it is actually you. As soon as you come into contact with an alternate or opposing perspective, that new wine, it is a direct attack on you. That hardened belief within collides with anything new and must reject it outright, otherwise it risks certain pain and suffering or tearing of the wineskin. However, in that fierce defending of what you hold to be truth, there's already a tear upon your garment. There's already clearly a battle waging. Note that this process doesn't necessarily need another person. Questioning yourself is enough to generate a fearful inner state. Let's think about what we commonly do in situations where our beliefs are challenged. We are likely to go out and search for even more supporting evidence to our inner truth. In seeking reassurance, we tend to gravitate towards like-minded people because there's a greater sense of security in a group. We are likely to try and harden that belief even more because the stronger that belief becomes, the more it can withstand and the more it can protect that which is most innocent, fragile, and frightened within us. The nature of belief, like memory, needs constant energy to be sustained. It must be recalled frequently and refreshed, otherwise it will begin to deteriorate and fade away. Whereas truth burns deep. It doesn't need recollection. Once you know something for certain, it will always be with you. The hypothetical fib of transmitting false information about the new winemaking process is just a simple example, and thankfully, this information, whether true or false, isn't going to cause you any pain and suffering necessarily. But we can easily see the fluidity of information exchange and how it spreads amongst us. Information has unknown origins and motives. It has likely been altered or undergone some type of transformation before finding its way to us. We may also observe that in addition to simply being spread to inform, it can also be used as a tool to either help or deceive. Very simply put, we aren't certain of what's arrived, whether true or false, friend or foe, noble or malicious, it must be isolated and carefully observed. We are too quick to trust, accept, and spread information as truth without being aware of the fact that we may be agents of fallacy. This generally happens because of the inherent trust we have in the person or the institution that fed us fallacy as truth. But we aren't interested in conspiracies here. We're not interested in speculating about whether or not they lie to us on purpose or maliciously to push some less than noble agenda or in complete ignorance. This way of thinking serves no actual purpose to the investigative process that must be undertaken nonetheless. We need to find out if what they're holding needs to be discarded immediately, or at the very least, stop from being spread further. The only way to truly do that is to question how it will improve us or our lives. The information that arrives at us via our senses can't be helped, just as the process that happened internally in response to the information can't really be helped. Perception, interpretations, theories, ideas, or choices emerge as an effect to the inner collisions of new information with existing beliefs. Every time we react or take action in response to a belief, it is not only serving to fortify that belief, but the belief itself is in complete control. We're merely attaching ourselves to that instinctive reaction in full confidence that the choice was made by us, despite the fact that it clearly originates within as a result of subconscious processes we don't fully understand. Further, any action, whether right or wrong, that emerges is fully justified by the belief itself, giving us a sense of security and righteousness. Information is like water. It's fluid and free-flowing, penetrating through every nook and cranny. We aren't certain of where it originates, because there are many sources, while beliefs are like rocks. Information collides with beliefs just as water crashes into rocks, unable to penetrate them. But no matter how gradual or unnoticeable the changes may be, that water has the power to grind stone into sand or carve canyons. That is, even though we may not realize it, information alone does have the power to change us very simply by gradually changing our core beliefs. The person we show the world is the result of the collisions between the information and beliefs. Truth, on the other hand, can't be changed and modified and still retain its core property of truth. Nothing can alter, collide with, or conflict with the truth. In addition, truth can never cause us pain. When they say truth hurts, it isn't the truth that causes the pain, but rather the belief structure that it shatters. It is the eradication of fallacy that we mistake for truth that hurts. Self-betrayal or self-deceit, seen clearly, are what actually cause pain. People will do almost anything, including self-deceit, to spare themselves that pain. However, no pain lasts forever, and although seeing truth isn't easy to accept, it eventually does lead to better days ahead. For any fallacy exposed, is fallacy eradicated. By starting at the new wine, the information itself, Jesus is not asking us to ignore the questioning process, the integrity of the information, the source of the information, or how it is relevant for us. Instead, he's asking us to be attentive and ready to receive it immediately, for we will have no other choice than to do so. The best we can do with information that we are inevitably to receive is channel it to the right place. This brings us to the wineskin, this repository, which is the clue for how we are to receive and contain the new information. The new wineskins are soft, pliable, and elastic. They can stretch to accommodate the fermentation process of the wine and not burst. Information, as it is being analyzed, is also undergoing a similar transformation process as it matures. We only mature externally because we constantly question ourselves and our beliefs. We mature because of the truth revealed to us by various life situations and subjective experiences. We all hold information we take to be true. We all hold some belief or another about the nature of reality, the creation of the universe, our purpose in this world, and how we ought to live our lives. We have our beliefs about God, the afterlife, around right and wrong action, and the criteria for determining right and wrong action. We have our life story, experiences, successes, triumphs, traumas, and failures. We hold information that causes regret and anxiety and causes all sorts of feelings and emotions to be invoked. It doesn't matter how it's actually contained or where. What matters is that it is in a state of movement. It is constantly changing, interacting, and expanding, just like the fermentation processes of wine. If new information that arrives at us is received in one of these old wineskins, it means we instinctively accept or reject it according to our aging and firm beliefs. To accept the new information is to agree with it immediately. This means that it only serves to fortify existing beliefs further. The expression, in one ear and not the other, is fitting in this situation. People on the spiritual path also use the term resonance to describe this process. For example, if this message resonates with you, or if you are in resonance with, that's another way of saying if you are either moved by, aligned with, or accept the message. To reject that new information immediately means you couldn't align with it. It couldn't be contained and wasn't allowed to mature and be investigated. Thus, it had no chance. That information, whether spilled due to a collision with a firm belief or being discarded because it fully aligns with an existing belief, are one and the same. Both lead to no interchange or transformation within you. Note that to protect or retain our beliefs, those hardened wineskins, we may actually be spilling or discarding information, solutions, or advice which may actually lead to truth and be beneficial for us. Jesus is asking us to receive this new information in new wineskins. He's asking us to isolate them and to look at them completely objectively and not through the lens of existing belief, because these collisions cause fear and emotions to arise. In viewing something objectively and not being led by impulsivity, we give our minds a chance to truly investigate in an unclouded state. Just as the new wineskin is flexible and elastic to that new wine, so too must we be with new information that we come into contact with. If fear arises, it means an eruption has already occurred. It means the fear has supplemented the original problem and is the actual problem or the tear in our garment that must be dealt with first. When we are attentive, we start to create a bit of separation between the processes that take place automatically within us as a result of these inner collisions. This observation reveals the truth about our way of functioning, the processes at work that give rise to choices and decisions. We don't have time to always analyze what we come into contact with and decide whether to accept or not. Life moves really fast, and like it or not, most of it is spent in reaction. It is precisely the reaction, however, that should be the focal point of our attention. It is this reaction that exposes our true beliefs. Even if we can't do the work in the moment, we must isolate the situation in New Wineskin and analyze it fully retroactively. What do we notice? Is there an insecurity? Is there a sense of superiority or entitlement? Is there a fear there that's causing us to react aggressively or defensively? When we learn to see and analyze our inner state, it will cause fear, but standing firm in honesty and the fact that the work is necessary to evolve spiritually will give us the courage and strength to continue and mature. Because we can't control the world or the information that finds its way to us, the only solution left in order to ensure no unwarranted conflicts can occur is to eradicate the fallacy, that rigidity within. Truth is neither hard nor rigid. Instead, there are infinite degrees of freedom in truth. Truth can't cause collisions, for we aren't in conflict with anything externally. Very simply put, in truth, there are no contradictions, constant questionings, doubt, or uncertainty. Truth does not behave the same as belief does. It is that new wineskin. It is flexible and pliable and receptive to any which way the information chooses to reveal itself. Any and all permutations are merely observed to expose something or another, but nothing can conflict with truth itself. We've all heard the expression, question your beliefs, or do your own research from various sources. After someone has openly shared their personal beliefs, they'll commonly challenge us with one or both of these statements. To question our beliefs, however, doesn't simply mean to tear apart a mountain, only to create a mound of gravel with the same mass and density right next to it. It doesn't mean to simply swap one belief for another because it brings us more comfort and security. Rather, it means to take a step back and see that though we've actually moved a mountain, there a mountain sits nonetheless. Though in another form, it's just as rigid and dense as the original. As the belief changes, so will we. But unless we can step back and see that we're no better off than when we started, we're no closer to spiritual growth. Seeing these changes helps a lot. Changing beliefs helps a lot to see our real selves, but only if we are attentive and looking where we should be. To question our own beliefs is akin to sampling the wine already fermenting in the new wineskin to determine if it is good quality or if it is spoiled and needs to be tossed out. This goes doubly for teachers, because speaking in full conviction to the most vulnerable and frightened amongst us should reveal our true motives and actions to ourselves. Are we confident in our message, or are we far too busy working to liberate the world that our own actions and beliefs elude us? Are we bothering to question the impact of the message we're transmitting, how it may be misunderstood, or giving false hope? Today, technology has enabled everyone to have a platform, even the ones for whom the platform may be dangerous. Thus, our job as spiritual seekers becomes a lot harder by first of all having to navigate this landscape. However, it does come down to an issue of resonance. So long as we are immature, we will tend to gravitate more to the wrong teachers. Eventually, if we are sincere about our growth, we will outgrow the teacher, just as the teacher may also outgrow their own message in their personal growth. Thus, no action needs to be taken, for we, both students and teachers, are exactly where we should be, and all students of something much greater. If years were wasted, think of it as an investment in oneself, and that this process was necessary to see and be drawn closer to truth. Everything has its opposite. Knowing the opposite means to see both sides in relation to one another. To question our beliefs means to see the dualistic nature of belief, to contemplate deeply and recognize that we are the final authority, We are the gatekeepers that ultimately assert true or false and decide whether or not to believe in one direction or another. However, due to the dualism that inherently exists, one side or another must be chosen, so long as there's an imbalance created by fear. Given a deeply hidden contradiction at the core, however, the question constantly arises. If that belief was actually true, there should be no contradiction, and no question should ever arise about it again. Further, if it was really true, no information that emerges to challenge your truth should have the ability to invoke fear because of the certainty and the confidence truth brings. For example, you don't ponder the nature of the hot stove or are torn about what would happen if you touched it. You may not necessarily recall the actual sensation of what it feels like to be burned, to know with full conviction that it will hurt because that truth was revealed to you long ago and potentially reinforced over and over again. Belief is a pseudo-truth, a seal or a placeholder used to create a barrier or separation between us and our ignorance. Consider all the unknown that exists out there that doesn't bother us in the least because we don't know a thing about it. We are not afraid of the unknown itself. We are only afraid of what it could mean if what we claim to know is actually false. The known has dualism and can be either true or false, but that is irreconcilable for our minds that are simple problem solvers and work to eradicate contradiction. The search is about introducing more contradiction where some already exist. It is to pursue the opposite of what we believe to be true and find just one fallacy that invalidates it all. Something dualistic can't be both true and false simultaneously, because that's an undefined concept. It means finding more and more information that will eventually lead one into clarity. In scientific proofs, it is sufficient to find one and only one condition that renders an entire hypothesis or theory false. Sometimes, this is the shortest path to truth, instead of setting out to find all conditions that converge to true. All beliefs arise out of the inherent and necessary conflict caused by dualism or opposing points of view. For example, if there is no God or no afterlife, what would it mean to perish and not be? However, if we were never told about God and the afterlife, the thought would never cross our minds. There would be no question or contradiction. Because our desire for life to extend far beyond our brief time here with those that we love, we want to continue beyond our physical death. We want something else to follow, and this beautiful theory of heaven or the one of reincarnation bring a sense of security, peace, and comfort. They allow us to function sanely in this world without constantly being afraid and paranoid of our certain death. The beliefs serve to push that can down the road and create as much separation between ourselves and that fear as possible. The spiritual journey, however, is not about pseudo-truths or beautiful and comforting ideas. It is about running towards that fear rather than hiding under barriers and barriers of rigid belief. We must have courage to run towards it and confront it. Whatever truth emerges, it is that which ultimately ends the contradiction and leads to liberation in this life. I'll tell you a story that happened on my own journey while I was contemplating the belief in God. So strong was my belief in God that I was afraid to ever challenge it. Whenever I heard an atheist speak, I pitied them for being completely lost and immediately rejected their perspective. It was so terrifying for me to reject God, and I couldn't fathom it, let alone utter the words that would lead to certain punishment. However, the journey started pushing me towards investigating this belief. It's almost as if I had no choice in it, and it needed to be done. I started by going into all the reasons that proved the existence of God for me, and immediately this gave me a great sense of comfort and security because I was on the side of good and righteousness. It took months to get the courage to even consider that my belief was wrong. I started to recognize the fear that seemed to always emerge when I went closer to investigate this belief. The answers that emerged from my depths in full honesty said, I was afraid because God is a certainty, and that to question Him is to be evil and to reject His blessings. But this was far from true. I was a good person. I was just curious to know how paralyzing fear could emerge out of mere curiosity. I found this fascinating, not only in this particular subject, but everywhere I held a firm belief, the same held true. Some discomfort or fear came up to push me away. But I kept reassuring myself I was perfectly fine, that I was perfectly safe, and had the right to question myself. I had the right to investigate the depths of my being, yet whether in the comfort of my own home, or out in the nature, by myself, where I frequently contemplated deeply, this fear was with me. I used to tell myself that there was no chance at being physically hurt, no reason why mere questioning should invoke so much fear. One day, I got the courage to reject the idea of God and everything I knew of God in its entirety. For the first time, I seen the totality of all I thought I knew about God just like anything else I had learned, as mere information that was given to me by this world. Adrenaline was pumping throughout my system, like I had been in a fierce battle and I anxiously awaited what would follow. But nothing happened. No immediate pain, no punishment, just that full rejection, and it brought some relief and an end to the built-up anxiety. I lived this way for some time without moral consequence. I had never been more free to know that nothing was going to hurt me or punish me for doing whatever I wanted to do and living life on my own terms. I said whatever I wanted to people without any regard, and there was nothing out of bounds. However, after a few months of my newfound freedom, I realized that my rejection of God was not actually based in truth, but rather in complete opposition to my previously held belief. This meant I still had a deep belief that God was simply a story and not real. I wrestled and wrestled, and once again I suffered. I was constantly going back and forth between believer and atheist, particularly when things in my life would take a turn for the worst. I felt the fear arise, and I related the events of my life as a punishment from God for rejecting Him. When things went well, I once again swayed in His direction and gave thanks. I would repent, and He would accept me once again. Back and forth I went, until fear stopped arising altogether, whether in one direction or another. And one day, in full clarity, a full separation occurred between awareness and the automatic happenings of the mind and body, reasoning for and against the existence of God. I witnessed my mind as it found inner proof for and it found inner proof against God. As the mind would toggle between the two points of view completely on its own and without my involvement, I came to the realization that I was completely and utterly clueless one way or another. The information for was the same as the information against. What mattered was merely the lens I was choosing to view the richness of all that information through. When it was looked at from a certain angle, it showed me a deep devotion and belief for the existence of God. However, when it was looked at from another angle, objectively and without fear, I'd conclude that God couldn't possibly exist. Both points of view simultaneously true and false in my mind concurrently. So strong and compelling were both cases, for and against, that the only thing I could do was to completely accept my utter ignorance. I was shocked as I recall saying, "Oh my God, it doesn't know." I didn't say, "I don't know," for in that separation, I was a complete spectator, divided from the processes of my mind. I was somehow completely detached while I was inspecting information from various angles. I could somehow see the processes that it was taking to make sense of this conflicting information in order to give end once and for all to this deep contradiction. This absolute obsession had completely taken over my life, and perhaps it may have even been a full-on psychotic break from reality. It's very possible, for I was spending most of my waking hours in contemplating, trying to figure out this burning question for myself. I simply did not know, and in that moment, I've never been more sure about anything in my whole life. I knew with 100% certainty that I was ignorant, and the fear of accepting that to myself was gone. What's more, I was also certain that irrespective of what the mind gave rise to in favor of either for or against the existence of God, could not possibly be accepted by me as absolute. The truth was already with me, in full clarity, and it would not allow a shaky belief to form. I realized that all the information that was ever transferred to me about this conflict originated in something similar to my own mind, in another person just like me, and not anything more evolved, divine, complex, or special, it made me realize that it was all a play of information, made real through feelings and emotions in the body, but particularly and most importantly, fear. However, in accepting that ignorance, I was finally in possession of a completely subjective truth not given to me by anyone or anything. It was firm and unshaken. Typically, in this state, fear would have pushed me towards accepting something, anything to avoid this ignorance, but because fear was absent, there was only stillness and silence. If there was any curiosity at all, it was fully devoted to understanding this state. After that, I spent a lot of time questioning my beliefs, and the unknown was categorically at the core of every single one. I remember always asking, "How do you know for certain?" or "How can you be so sure?" And the answers always originated outside of me and adopted to mask my own ignorance or fear. It was always some author, some documentary, some preacher, some teacher, or some lecture, but nevertheless, some other mind that convinced me to adopt their point of view as my own in that fearful and volatile state of ignorance. The information was always someone else's wine finding its way into my wineskin. In the unknown, I had finally discovered how to isolate information and give it a chance to expand, contract, and ferment to see if I can extract from it anything true. I remember telling myself that all the belief that failed this test had no place in my being. Every day, I'd eradicate something else simply because I was no longer afraid to do so. However, losing one's beliefs is to start losing one's identity. And in that separation, I realized that the unknown, the ignorance, was truth itself. That truth that could not be contested was my true nature, who I actually was, and not merely something resembling belief that I happened to be in possession of. This process led to a cataclysm of sorts. I was completely disconnected and betrayed by the lies I had lived for so long, maybe even discombobulated and lost about what it all meant for the future. I had no regard for anyone or anything. I quit my job. I stopped caring. I stopped loving. I stopped seeking. I stopped wanting, and it was all far too much. The only thing I could do for 3 straight months was answer every question that ever arose with "I don't know." In full sincerity, I was a blank canvas. Having given up fully my fascination with fairy tales and fantasy, I finally turned towards that ignorance and that truth. I turned towards that undefined light of my inner self, and I asked it to show me the way. I vowed to live my life according to whatever truth that light revealed. That was the actual start of my spiritual journey. It only started when I finally eradicated out of every deeply held belief that I actually knew nothing at all about, and realized that they had no value other than serving to suppress the fear and uncertainty of the future. I turned off all the teachers, all the books, all the shows, all the conspiracies and nonsense, all the religions and sworn paths, messages and ways. I sought firsthand truth, exploring the world like a child who had just been born. I settled for the bits and pieces of objective truth all around me that I never noticed before, due to my inner ambitions to know the absolute truth out there. The senses became so tightly integrated with reality. I couldn't tell where they ended and the world started. Thought completely stopped. That constant chatter in my mind was nowhere to be found. Thinking still occurred, but it was no longer heard as before. I was in a state of complete amazement, especially when engaging with my 3-year-old son. Life became a project, something to learn from and something to constantly work towards improving. In that depth of attention, imperfection stood out like a sore thumb, and slowly the light of that truth worked to reveal everything I was interested in, learning exactly how the world and my body worked without the need for speculations or belief. The process was painful, and most lessons involving addictions particularly were learned through failing over and over until the truth was finally revealed, allowing me to move forward. At the start of what I thought was the real path, and in my immaturity, I failed to fully grasp the spoken word of the master because I didn't see anything deeper there. I saw only the message on the surface, and though I managed to understand it at that level, I never felt it necessary to dive deeper to extract anything more. Perhaps I didn't know the process, or perhaps I just wasn't ready yet. What I cling to most was the blind belief and allegiance in the Son of God, Him by whom all are saved and redeemed. I took comfort in my Christianity, my baptism, and knowing that I was saved despite being completely lost and in the dark, in all aspects of my life. Living by His word alone was far too difficult, particularly about being selfless and loving others as oneself. I concluded that it was completely impossible, and that if He truly lived that way, He must have really been divine. However, knowing full well I wasn't divine, there was no hope for me. So instead, I took the long journey through various schools of thought and various teachers. I took in libraries of information so incredibly complex and difficult to understand because I very simply didn't know how to investigate my own being and question myself. All this was necessary just to be able to get near the understanding of Christ. It wasn't until I was called back to the Gospels and particularly the parables that I really started to question why I couldn't live life according to His teachings. Why was it so difficult, so seemingly impossible? It was difficult because I was impulsive and not fully in control of my actions. It was difficult because my mind was constantly clouded and I couldn't see clearly. It was difficult because I was afraid. It was difficult because of all the constant collisions of new information with my rigid systems of belief. It was difficult because I couldn't see the world objectively and make non-emotional decisions. It was difficult because I was living in fallacy, for nothing I was holding was my own. So what is the solution? The solution is attention. It is complete devotion to the study of oneself and reactions to external stimuli to see the beliefs that are actually in firm control. Jesus is the new wine, the new message, and in the spirit of this parable, He isn't asking us to accept anything blindly. No, in fact, He's asking us to deeply question even His teaching by setting it aside in a new wineskin without the influence of our past experiences and beliefs. If the wine proves to be good and enjoyable, then in your full awareness, you will know. If there is fear in your awareness, you will also know that too, and it will give you a chance to investigate and trace it back to the belief that caused it to arise. This way, you can do the necessary work required to address it. You're going to fail over and over again, but the beauty is that you are always forgiven and invited to start fresh. One day, you will look back on the megastructure of effort, trials and errors, successes and failures, and know that it's there completely apart from you. And despite of you, in the moment, there will be crystal clarity. The nature of belief is like a game of Jenga. Once you yank that one piece, that one deeply held belief that's closest to your core and defines you, the whole thing will come crumbling down as it must, because there is no solid foundation of truth holding it. It is a flimsy structure of low integrity, and sufficiently observing it exposes the weaknesses required for it to fall. The parables of the Master are new because they drastically differ from anything that came before or since, and for that reason, they are as new today as they ever were. Forgiveness is always new in a world entrenched in revenge. Love is always new in a world constantly consumed by hate. And equality for all people, in the light of truth, is always new in a world of inequality and oppression. Thank you for your attention, and may God bless you.